Thank you very much. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here with all of you today, and a pleasure also to be with my distinguished co-panelists. I was trying to figure out, I think we have at least 150 years experience with the TRIPS agreement on the panel, and could discuss those technical matters in some detail. I'm going to say at a somewhat high level of abstraction or generality, but I had promised at the start to make a few reactions to Jayshree's kind of historical perspective on the WTO, TRIPS, and public health. And I want to start by saying that I think one needs to be a bit careful about looking at the WTO history and public health through rose-colored glasses. And I don't attribute this at all to Jayshree. She was there very closely and I think always played a progressive role in these matters. But if one thinks back to the 1997-1998 period, when South African government had come under furious assault from U.S. trade negotiators and the EU, and ultimately by the 39 pharmaceutical companies, the primary basis of the claim lay in a technical point under the TRIPS agreement, that is that authorization of parallel imports of patented medicines was prohibited by the TRIPS agreement. And that was the fundamental basis of the claim. Now, at the time, I don't think there was any real disagreement among WTO law and TRIPS experts in Geneva about whether or not Article 6 of the TRIPS agreement authorized differential perspectives on parallel trade. I recall we had organized a conference in Geneva at the Graduate Institute in 1998, in which really there was no speaker who would have asserted a position otherwise. And yet, with that, I would say, common knowledge and position among TRIPS experts, it was not until with the active intervention of Doctors Without Borders and petitions with a million signatures and Oxfam and protests in the streets in South Africa and threats to the integrity of the pharmaceutical industry that ultimately in 2001 the industry withdrew its case in Pretoria and finally conceded that the TRIPS agreement did not in fact prohibit a differential perspective on exhaustion. And what bothered me at the time, and what bothers me to this day, is that it would have been relatively simple for the Director General of the WTO in 1998, 1999, 2000, to have made a statement that, he has discussed this with WTO law experts within the organization, and he doesn't think that the United States, the EU, and the industry are really on the right course here in this case. And I realize that this raises the always troubling issue of the WTO being a member-driven organization, and who is the Director General, after all, to intervene in a case involving countries and parties. And yet, I would have made then, and I make the argument now, that there are some cases in which an exception needs to be made, in particular because the damage done to the reputation of the WTO as an organization arising from that series of events was really quite serious and persisted for years, and I might even say has persisted to this day. So there's a lot of detail that we could go into about what then happened with the Doha Declaration. I'll just mention briefly, one of the main reasons we have the Doha Declaration we had in the form we had it was the tragic events of September 11th in New York in the United States, which caused an enormous fragility in the global trading system and a real desire to get something done in Doha that up until that time, it really hadn't been self-evident we would have had that result. So there's a lot of historical background, and I just note parenthetically for those of you who aren't following it, that right today the U.S. Supreme Court has before it the case of whether the United States will have international exhaustion with respect to patents of the case called Impression Products v. Lexmark International. And it is at least some comfort to think that our Supreme Court has already recognized that a country can adopt the rule of exhaustion that it chooses. That's not really an issue in the case. I hesitate to say how the Supreme Court's actually going to come out on this. But one of the reasons I mentioned the old history, because I hate to be up on old history, is the WTO is facing a maybe not quite so serious, but somewhat serious matter today with the tobacco cases. I don't want to go into too much detail because people here in this room are considering the case at some point, but Thomas mentioned it. But it's a case from a public health standpoint with potentially equally serious implications as the case against South Africa back in the late 1990s. So it's something to pay attention to in terms of the organization. Now, I probably spent all my time here without even getting to the substance of my remarks, but I'll just take a few minutes with some general observations about the future of TRIPS and IP and the WTO. And we heard last night, and I think apparent to everybody in the room, we're in the midst of a tectonic shift in global trade policy. At least we seem to be in the midst of a tectonic shift. If one listened to the inaugural remarks of the incoming president of the United States, with its very dark tone and with its clear message that the United States had been taken advantage of by its trading partners for decades now of bad deals, something which would naturally come to us as a surprise to the trade negotiators on the other side of those deals in this room. But in particular, the idea that actually from the standpoint of exercise of leverage, things were likely to get worse rather than better. If America hadn't been first, it will now be first, which implies an even greater exercise of leverage. And I think intellectual property is naturally an area where some of these issues are going to be very important and will be thinking about change. Of course, as you're all well aware, and we have the negotiators here, this was the case in 1984, in 1979, in 1989, and so forth, that the perspective from the U.S., the EU, and Japan was that, first world assets were not being adequately protected, the developing countries were taking advantage of the North. And it's interesting to see that even though we've had the TRIPS agreement for more than 20 years now, and even if you leave aside perhaps a few LDCs, virtually every country in the world today is TRIPS compliant, the complaints about the lack of adequate intellectual property protection and theft of first world assets are as vigorous today as they were then, perhaps even more. And why is this so difficult? Well, Kenneth Arrow explained to us a long time ago that technology is kind of leaky. It's very hard to contain. And if you put technology in a vault where only a certain number of people have the access codes, you're not going to have that leakage, which in my own view is a good thing. We want technology to leak. We don't want to keep it restrictive in a vault. And I think that leads to overall improvements in global welfare. And a major positive event from the standpoint of, let's call it protecting the right to leakage, was the appellate body's first decision in the India mailbox case, where it confirmed the availability of TRIPS flexibilities and that each government could implement its rules in its own way. And this has been a very big help. For example, here in India, as it has defended Section 3D of its Patent Act and the requirement of substantial enhancement of efficacy in granting the patents on new forms of known compounds. And even the Swiss trade experts, when they looked at that case, they were encouraged by Novartis to bring action against the Indian government, said, the TRIPS agreement just isn't that fixed, right? The requirement of efficacy is certainly something that's possible. So, of course, we've had for a long time this idea that Thomas mentioned of a shift to looking at the TRIPS agreement as much as a protective device, as a restrictive device, But equally, for the past 15 years and more, we've had the idea that we should, that we need more protective standards than the TRIPS standards. So, you know, the US, the EU, and other countries have been going out negotiating stricter standards. The TPP, which has now been unsigned, as you know, had 8 years market exclusivity for biologic drugs, which is something which would very seriously impact the Indian biologics industry. And so these extensions are not necessarily trivial from the standpoint of industrial development from countries like India. We have some very mixed signals about the whole IP business coming out of Washington. It's very difficult to decipher. Well, on one hand, we have some positive. We've talked about federal price negotiations. But the president has also alluded to getting rid of regulations of the pharmaceutical sector that require companies to show efficacy in order to have approval of the drug, and getting rid of the regulation of pharmaceutical plants for good manufacturing practice so it's easier to build plants in the United States, and telling companies that they have to move production back to the United States and out of, for example, India. So these are kind of interesting developments. It's hard to say what this is all going to mean in practice. It may end up meaning nothing in practice. This all may just be words, but I guess when I come to the whole of the substance is that if you read the idea of America First and need for greater degrees of protection, I don't see this new administration as coming out and softening its negotiating position on things like new TRIPS Plus standards. I'm more inclined to think we'll see a demand for 12 or 15 years for biologic exclusivity than we will see a relaxation so that we have easier access. And I suppose you could look at that from a mercantile perspective. Well, I have other things to say. I think I'll, in the interest of time, I won't go through them. I do think there's some room for multilateral TRIPS negotiations at the WTO, for example. I suspect there is more sympathy towards concluding some negotiations on geographical indications than might be given credit. There's many countries that want them. I don't think the United States is so recalcitrant as it might have been in the past. So if that were a standalone agreement, I think one might actually make some progress. I think the difficulty comes back to the historic one. If you agree to open up GI, the conclusion of GI's negotiations, if demands will be made to add an extension for biologics exclusivity with drugs, and demands will be made to increase in enforcement standards, so you'll come back in a circular way to where you started from, which is some difficulty in reaching agreements on these things. As I mentioned last night, it's not at all surprising. I would be shocked, in fact, if this group of WTO scholars and judges didn't conclude that it would be a good idea to bring things back to the WTO. That's what everyone is doing for a living. And there's obviously reasons that make sense. It particularly may make sense because we have an appellate body that to date has demonstrated evident good sense and understanding and appreciation of subtleties and nuances and how to approach things, so it would be a good idea to have greater focus on the WTO and movement away from these bilaterals. My difficulty with this is I'm not sure that there's really public support or public demand for this. It's very hard to perceive politicians moving forward on the idea that we're going to increase globalization and focus our attention on multilateral institutions. So my guess is from the standpoint of countries that are worried about ratcheting intellectual property standards and other matters in bilaterals and so forth, that it's really time to focus on retaining national sovereignty, to staying out of the race to the ever more concessionary bilateral, to basically see if there's a comfortable place to sit on the sidelines and wait out the current environment. It's a strange piece of advice, but it's the best one I have to offer. So thank you.